Hello, everybody. This is Kyle Flaherty, Security Nation, episode 25. That's right. Security Nation can finally rent a car, so that's exciting. Today, I got to speak with Joel Cordella and Wade Woolwine, two just unbelievably respected and knowledgeable folks in the security industry have been doing this for a while, though Wade likes to throw around the fact that, he aged himself younger than Joel and I near the end of the podcast, so you can get to that at some point. But we actually talked about a topic that was brought up via our listeners. It was one when we sourced what folks wanted to hear about. It was managing or building and managing a SOC. And so that's what we hit on. And we talked about a lot of things, not just the building and managing of it, but the importance of people, what to look for, how to measure success, how to communicate. Communicate was a word that was probably brought up more than anything else. Not only communication skills from the standpoint of the people who work for you in a SOC or the people who work for you at the service provider that is providing a SOC, but also yourself. If you're, the client, the customer, how you're communicating with those folks and how a better communication program overall can really help better secure what you're doing. And so I thought that was pretty interesting. It wasn't something that I had actually thought about. So we dive into that in terms of how to build a strategy, how to know when you should actually go in this direction, and what to look for overall when you're actually moving towards a SOC, whether it's something that you're building in-house, you're a larger organization, or it's a service provider that you're going to work with, outside of what you're doing. So please enjoy episode 25 with Joel and Wade. I certainly did.
You're listening to Security Nation with host Kyle Flaherty.
Let me pull up my notes so I have them in front of me so I don't seem like a complete scatter. All right, cool. Let me start. Actually, this topic was something that came to us from our customer community. So we put out what they wanted to hear, and this is the 25th episode of Security Nation, so I figure what a great way to celebrate what we're talking about. So let's start real easy. We're talking about SOCs, Security Operations Centers. For those maybe new, folks who don't understand what that means, what kind of constitutes that minimal viable product, if you will, of what a SOC kind of should be?
Sure. So first and foremost, you've got to kind of decide whether SOC is something that you need or not based on your overall IDR strategy. A lot of organizations, frankly, don't have enough data that they're trying to protect that they really need that kind of monitoring. Now, that's a gross statement, but it is what it is. Now, from an MVP perspective, again, it really depends on what you're trying to accomplish. There are companies out there that aren't supporting a ton of critical data. So just monitoring for, kind of what I like to call the IT problem as far as commodity malware, CryptoLocker, and things that are just kind of distributed automatically throughout the internet. You can have a small SOC or what I would call an immature SOC, something that's just going to respond to signature-based alerts and tell you to pull systems offline when you have them. Now, the flip side of that, if you are a financial organization, if you are the top dog in your industry with trade secrets, which if you lost your competition, you would lose your edge, well, then you really have to look at the cutting edge of SOCs, SOCs that are able to not only do threat intelligence and signature-based detection, but also do behavior-based detection, be able to protect you from those threats that are going to come in with a custom piece of malware that's never been seen anywhere. They're going to use custom infrastructure that no one has ever used before, or they're going to use malware that is just so incredibly complex that you don't have a hope and a dream to catch it with traditional signature-based stuff. So using behavior analytics, using threat hunts, and having that SOC also be able to provide incident response services would be kind of MVP if you need that kind of service. But it's really about what do you need based on what you're trying to protect.
Yeah, super important too, understanding what you need. Wade and I were having some discussions around this before this. Very often we have clients that really don't know what they don't know, and they're unaware of what their capabilities are. So helping to determine what those capabilities are is very important, because for any operations that you're going to get out of what Wade is talking about in a traditional SOC, there's a lot of output that's going to come from that entity. And you as an organization have to ingest that input, you have to process it, and you have to run with it, right? So whether it's incident response or whether it's other kinds of activities that are going to drive organizational processes, you have to be prepared to do the intake, you have to be prepared to execute, and ultimately, you know, deal with the results of that.
All right, so let me then ask you, Joel, of I'm unaware of my capabilities, I'm unaware of what I actually need. How do you suggest I actually figure that out?
So the first thing that you have to determine is, do you have a strategy, right? That's the most important thing. So we talked about like an IR strategy. Do you have incident response as a strategic part of what your organization does? And that doesn't mean that you have an incident response plan written down. It means, do you have a strategy? Do you understand what you're going to do when it comes to, you know, basic threats, when it comes to advanced threats? Do you have the skills and abilities within your own organization to do that? So that's going to be like a gap assessment, right? So you need to do a skills gap assessment and understand what can you do versus what you can farm out to a third party. You know, and doing these foundational kinds of exercises are very, very important to understanding where you are, where you need to go, and, you know, drawing those lines. I mean, we're big in IT and we're big in security on drawing pictures. So draw those pictures, figure that stuff out. And wherever you see these gaps and you can't connect these dots, that's where you need to reach out for help.
Yeah, and the strategy piece is really important, especially at the executive level, right? Because at the end of the day, security programs exist because businesses are in place. Therefore, the broader strategy really needs to come from the board or the executive level. And it's going to come in fluffy terms like, we must protect the blah, 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 or the blah, 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 and that's fine. But getting that kind of direction from your executive team is really step number one. Having your executive team care enough to make that a priority and then subsequently invest is going to be the pre-step that kicks off the processes that Joel was just talking about.
Well, and it sounds like there, Wade, it's, you know, it may be fluffy, but I have to translate that language into something that actually means something for me. And I think a lot of people struggle with that still. I mean, we've talked about that on every topic. We've talked about how difficult it is to figure out what the business side is telling us and what that actually means to what I'm supposed to do in my job as a security practitioner.
Yeah, and that's a lot of the work that both Joel and I do, right? I mean, he's kind of focused on broader security programs as a whole. I'm laser focused on incident detection and response. But at the end of the day, the work that Joel does really lays the foundation for what I'm going to come in and do afterwards. There's no sense in implementing a world-class IDR program if you can't wrangle the basics of security, if you don't have security awareness, if you don't have defense in depth, if you don't understand your attack surface. So the two really flow together. When I talk about IDR programs, I'm not just talking about the ability to detect and respond. I'm talking about the ability to be resilient against threats, apply monitoring where you're less resilient, and then be able to respond appropriately to get that attacker out of your environment before they can cause real damage.
Right, root cause analysis to make sure it doesn't happen again, right? These are all important kinds of organizational processes that have to be observed because, again, this is what I would consider an advanced topic. And there may not be people who are ready to do it, even though everybody should do it. You know, you may not be ready. It's very, very possible, right? But let me just comment on something you said there, Kyle, because when it comes to that business translation issue, right, how do we translate business objectives into security objectives? I think the one piece of advice that I give all the time is you have to understand how your decisions are made. So if I go to a client and they are buying security technology, for example, the question I will ask is, what did you base this decision on? And you will find a lot of the time people don't really know. Or maybe it was something that an executive read in a magazine or something they thought they needed. Right. So the most important thing you can do when it comes to any kind of decision making, and especially when it comes to business priority, is just to jot down how you come to the decisions you come to. That way, not only can you make more effective decisions, you can make them consistently. So even if they're bad, they're consistently bad and they can be fixed. Right. And they're defensible and justifiable. Right. To executives and management. So just understanding those basic things, you know, having a few things written down to say, you know what, we're not going to do anything in security unless it supports one of our business goals, which is, you know, doubling our size in the next 2 years or, you know, whatever that could be.
Yep.
Yeah. And then taking that kind of business goal and translating it a little bit, one of the aspects that we work on with customers a lot is, what do you have? Where is it? and what is the likelihood that an attacker is going to target you based on what you have. So we bring in the aspects of operational and tactical threat intelligence, understanding why the attackers do what they do, what motivates them, why do they go after financial information, why do they go after PII? Well, it's pretty easy. It's because they can sell that information on the black market and benefit from it. So taking a threat-based approach and mirroring that up to what you have, and then taking in the into account where does it reside, really allows you to build up that complete security program that is laser focused on protecting what the attackers are going to come after, instead of being wooed by an awesome salesperson or, you know, a babe at RSA. Whatever your motivation is for buying that particular product, you know, make sure that it aligns with not just your business strategy, but the translation of that business strategy into the real components of your IDR programs.
All right, so let's dive into that a little bit more. If we're talking about, you know, I heard justifiable, I heard, you know, business speak, I heard all the different kind of language that we want to make sure we level set. And let's say we figure that all out. Awesome. Good for us. Yay. How do I know it's actually working? How do I know that I'm not talking return on investment. I'm not talking any like the BS marketing terms. But it's like, how do I know that what I just put my neck out for and figured out, I can justify when it comes to SOC in particular? I get it in a lot of other realms, but when it comes to this one, how am I measuring success?
Wow, that is an interesting, complex question. I think the security metrics conversation has been going on for the better part of the whole time the security industry has been around, and I don't think we've come to a good solution. You know, the way that I like to help customers understand and measure really the effectiveness of the program is by looking across the entire prevention to incident response lifecycle, right? So you buy prevention technology, and the goal of that prevention technology is that it's going to do a fairly good job at blocking the threats that it knows about, and it's going to offload a lot of work from your people. So starting at the prevention space and measuring how many threats make it through that prevention layer into the detection layer, now you've determined the effectiveness of your prevention technology, giving you metrics to swap pieces of technology out as you see changes in the threat landscape or ineffectiveness of the technology that you already have in place. Now, right, with the measurement of what makes it through prevention to detection, now all of a sudden you're able to measure some of your human cost, because detection at the end of the day is assisted by technology, but really, in order to have a good detection program, you need to have people on top of it. You need the validation portion. Is this a true positive or a benign event? And then from there, if you measure the number of detection events that lead to incident response, you're basically measuring the effectiveness of your technology and people in the detection space, which allows you to make tweaks as needed. Because at the end of the day, measuring metrics for the sake of measuring metrics is a pointless exercise. Measuring metrics for the purpose of tweaking your program, tweaking your technology, tweaking your people is really where it's at.
Yeah, and that's an efficiency question that Wade is right, talking to, which absolutely, you know, we try, whenever we have engagements with clients, we say, look, we're coming in here from the standpoint of security, but at the end of the day, you know, we're trying to be efficiency experts. We're trying to do things for you that is going to introduce efficiency into your organization, because what we find is attackers take advantage of chaotic organizations, chaotic opportunities. And if we can lessen that chaos and make you more efficient, you get the business benefit of being more efficient, which is more cost effective, and you get the security benefit of not being as opportunistic and taken advantage of. And then to add on what Wade was saying, you know, one of the ways that I guess I would measure, although I completely agree with him when it comes to the metrics question, but you know, if you have a good understanding of your data and where it's at, so let's say that you're doing data classification well, okay, and you understand that there are certain crown jewels of data that exist in your organization, and maybe you're a healthcare entity, so that winds up being HIPAA data. Or maybe you are a financial services and it might be something around your the products and services that you're supporting. Or maybe where I came from in manufacturing, everything revolved around pricing because, you know, you make cement the same way for 100 years and there's really no secrets out there anymore, right? So pricing becomes the crown jewels. So these are the things that we focus our efforts on to say, do we have incidents in and around these things we consider our crown jewels? And if we don't, we know we're doing something right. right? Especially if we can measure incidents in other spaces.
Yeah.
So that in itself is sort of a derived metrics, an implied metric, if you will. But I think it's an important one to say, hey, look, you know, we can outline all of these things and classify these different types of systems and data, and everything that's here, which is the stuff we're most important or most concerned about, is being left alone, and that's good on us.
Yeah. It was a trick question.
Well, and I think the last piece there is if the FBI comes and knocks on your door, what you're doing is not working.
Right. You might want to rethink your plan.
Well, it depends on why they're knocking on your door. It's never good news, but it might have nothing to do with your security practice. At that point, you may want it to be. So I think both of you mentioned people in this whole thing. I wonder, too, you know, whether I'm doing this myself, I'm in a large financial institution, whether I'm outsourcing it, most likely, whatever it is, you know, and it's a loaded question, of course, but I'm just wondering from your perspective, as people who have built these things, hired these people, all that stuff, what are you looking for out of these types of folks? What's the secret sauce? Because of course, we all hear about how hard it is to hire and resources and blah, 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 all that stuff. God knows I use it in all of my marketing endlessly. But you know, for folks like you, like how important are the people?
I mean, for the business that we run here at Rapid7 with the managed detection and response, the people are really everything. We have architected our service so that we have a reliance on threat intelligence and signature-based detection, but we also add behavior analytics, hunts, and incident response on top of that. And those three last components, you can automate a lot of that. You can automate the data collection and some of the context gathering, but at the end of the day, you need a person to make decisions about what they're seeing. And when you add a level of complexity in having to understand the customer environment in order to effectively be able to deliver things like user behavior analytics, you really need a smart group of people driving the ship there, right? So some of the things that we look at just in our general hiring practices above and beyond technical acumen, right? I mean, that's pretty much a given.
Right.
You need to vet your SOC people for experience and technical knowledge. But we really look for the ability to operate as a team. I know this is probably the most cliche hiring practice in the world, but when you are dealing with high-pressure situations where you need a lot of people to come to the table very quickly to drive detection, drive context gathering, drive incident response analysis and malware analysis and all these things, you need people that are comfortable operating as a team. You need folks who over-communicate rather than under-communicate. You need people who are not going to get their feelings hurt because the analyst sitting two chairs down from them is doing the thing that you usually do. Like, you just have to keep on rolling with the team aspect of things. The second thing we really look for is thinking outside of the box, right? Attackers are known for thinking outside of the box. That is pretty much why they are so successful at what they're doing. How can I take this weird Microsoft exploit and turn it into a backdoor? How can I look at a defense in depth infrastructure and identify the hole in it and move in that way? That's what attackers do. Therefore, as defenders, we need to do the absolute same thing. What can I do with this large set of data? How can I look at it differently? How can I apply different analytics on top of it? That's really what we look for in thinking outside of the box. Come up with ideas that no one else has come up with. Come up with ideas that other people have come up with and have turned away because it was too complicated to implement. Like, we need those kind of people. And then last but not least, the ability to communicate. That plays into the whole teamwork thing. But when you're running a 24/7 operation, you have to count on those people, those analysts, the SOC people who traditionally are introverts and don't want to talk to people. They just want to, you know, find evil and solve crime all day. We need people to communicate because if something happens in the middle of the night, we have to wake up our customer, who's typically going to be a director or C-level. You know, we can't have a shy, timid person who's scared of communicating, who can't effectively communicate the high points to an executive very quickly to get them engaged. So communication is absolutely critical on our end. Joel, I don't know if there's if there are different skill sets that you look for kind of in the work that you're doing suggesting SOCs to customers.
Yeah, for me, it's all about that C word, right? It's communication all day, every day. Really smart people are great, but really smart communicators are hard to find. And you need them on both sides, right? So I'm a client advocate. When I go to a client site, I'm the client advocate. And if we're doing things like helping them with SOC services, we've got to make sure that whoever they're engaging with has lines of communication that are understandable by those parties, right? Because they're again on the intake side of that process. So the SOC is producing this output and going, we have this stuff. They can communicate it well, but if the customer can't understand it, that's a problem too. So we really have to work on, you know, finding those common language kinds of things. You know, my big complaint in security is we can have entire conversations with using 13 letters of the alphabet, and then sometimes we get confused because we forget, you know, what our context is, right? And if we do that to our customers, it's even worse.
Yeah.
So it really, really, really is important to stress that strong communication. And then, you know, the technical stuff, again, you know, I personally leave that to the smart people like Wade and his folks to get that information and to do something with it. At the end of the day, again, you know, we can do skills gaps all day. We can find people who are good at what they do. But, you know, Wade hit it on the head. If they're timid and they can't engage, it's not going to go anywhere. And, you know, attackers take advantage of that and they count on that kind of stuff, right? Yep. So having those open lines of communication, I mean, 100%.
And even just hearing you guys describe it, I mean, that's a tough, I can see why it's hard to find that kind of breed of person. And one thing that's been interesting in doing this podcast, I've had a few customers on recently, and I always ask them the question about how they find people. And the creativity one always comes up, the communication one always, those always come up. But one of the things they always say too is that they actually have stopped looking necessarily at just people who have gone through the different certs or the classic kind of approach. And Jack Voth, who I had on recently, was talking about how he found some guy at the local like BP gas station who had just been hacking the crap out of the cash register and like doing some stuff with it. And that guy ended up, you know, lifelong, you know, he's been in the industry now for 15 years or whatever. And he's, you know, an all-star down in that area. And so I thought that was, and I'm sure you just got to look, you guys have to be as creative with your hiring as you need those people to be creative in their jobs.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's the interesting part is it's not all about the hiring. Sure. Finding talent is a hard thing. Retaining talent is even harder, especially if you are operating SOC for a single business. One of the appeals that we have as a service provider is we're looking in hundreds of customer environments all at once. So, you know, one day is never the same as the next, and we constantly keep our people busy. One of the things that I hear most from the folks that we hire out of private SOCs is, hey, I was just sitting there bored. You know, I mean, we have all the technology in the world. We have all the data in the world. The fact of the matter is there's only going to be 1, 2, maybe 3 significant breaches a year in some of these larger organizations that can afford to build their own SOC. And folks just don't want to stay around if they're not going to be excited, if they're not going to have something to do every single day.
Right. Yeah, that's good. So speaking of people, though, when you're looking at a SOC or you're looking at maybe hiring somebody to outsource this, can you have too many people?
Yes. Yes, you definitely can. Right. We have kind of a unique way of doing things here at Rapid7. Maybe not unique. Maybe I'm just, you know, thinking that our hiring practices are awesome and that we're always ahead of the ball. But we want to right-size our organization such that folks are not overworked, that work-life balance is extremely critical, especially in a high-stress job like incident response or SOC analysts. But by the same token, you know, I don't want people sitting there twiddling their thumbs doing nothing because that is what leads to job dissatisfaction and boredom, and then eventually they leave and we lose the significant amount of investment that we've done in training them up and things like that. So yes, it's an absolutely fine balance and something that you have to tweak all the time. So we look, you know, we have a broad rule around number of customers, number of endpoints that we use to right size the various tiers of analysts in our SOC. But we're constantly tweaking that. And I think one of the aspects that is working really, really well for us is that not just within the managed detection and response service, but all over Rapid7, you know, our leadership is very strong, very interested, whatever the word is, in making sure that people management is done right. So doing things like one-on-ones, feedback, coaching, things like that are all part of every single manager at Rapid7's roles and responsibilities. Therefore, Mike Scutt, who runs my security operations center here in Alexandria, he has one-on-ones with every single analyst on his team every single week. And by using that, that method, we're constantly aware of what's working, what's not working. Are we overstaffed or understaffed? And we use that feedback from the SOC analyst to tweak those formulas that we use to justify our hiring to the business and matching against a customer pipeline to make sure that we're not behind on hiring. We always have to be ahead.
Yeah, and is that something that, you know, maybe Joel, you can grab this, is that those types of things, they're not soft. I mean, they're definitely, and I don't mean it in that negative way, but when I'm examining a service provider, are those things that I should even consider beyond obviously the technical stuff and all the other stuff we just talked about, like how you actually treat your people and your employees?
Oh yeah, no, I think it's 100% important. Let me give you a perspective of actual customers. So my last job, I was a CISO and I had some managed services that were provided to me. And the problem that I had was, because the question you ask is, can you have too many people? We never knew week to week and month to month, sometimes the people that we were dealing with, we were always getting new names. They were always coming up. And as a customer, that gets extremely frustrating. Because at some point, you get to the point where you're like, look, I've got to have somebody who can help me with whatever this problem is.
Right.
Right. And if I've got one person that's my go-to, and that's the person I always go to, that's great for me as a customer. It may suck on the actual management side. You know, you have to balance that a little bit. But here's what I can say. If that was one person or it was two people, but it was always the same, that's okay. Right. When it's 100 people or 50 or 10 or even 5, that's too many. So you have to get that balance in you know, how can we provide services but have that open line, again, back to communication, right? That open line of communication, that avenue, and get to them what they need, when they need it, and you know, fulfill those needs, those services, those requests.
So let's keep going. Let's dive into that a little bit more, because I think that brings me into one of the questions that I had for you guys of scope and, you know, scope creep and like all the different things. So what should you expect? And Joel, especially, you know, from where you've been, what should you expect when it comes to managing this type of, you know, this service provider, and how you can actually manage or reduce or whatever, I guess maybe reduce is the wrong word, but it's just manage that scope to the success criteria that we talked about previously.
So the first thing that I would say is, if you are involved with any kind of third party and you're managing that third party, you have to basically over communicate. If you're dissatisfied with something, you need to say, I'm dissatisfied with this. Because if you don't give that feedback, they have no way of being able to fix whatever the problem is. They're not even aware of it. It's one of those unknown unknowns, right?
Yeah.
So you as the customer, you don't feel like you're complaining or over complaining. And maybe they talk about you behind your back. That's fine. Everybody does it, right? It's okay. Don't feel bad. It's not an emotional thing. This is a business relationship, and you have to understand that feedback is so important. So just as the SOC should be giving the proper feedback down to the customer so they can ingest and do things with incidents and response, you as a customer have to come back and go, look, I don't understand these graphs that you're showing me. I don't understand these weekly reports. I don't understand the terminology you're using. Don't feel bad. Don't feel dumb. Like, there are no dumb questions when it comes to that. So in managing a relationship, that's the most important thing, is to make sure that what you're getting as a customer is you're getting it in a way that you understand it, that you can do something with it, and then you can move on with it. And I know, having worked with service providers and having that kind of relationship, that they are 100% amenable to that, and they can do it. Outside of, you know, truly weird customizations where, you know, it's just nobody in the world does this kind of stuff, you know, for the most part, I think that they can be accommodating and do what you need to do to work with them,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, and to add to that, one of the things that I love to say all the time is, you can't outsource everything, right? I mean, we can do a lot of the technical, we can do all of the technical analysis work for you. We can monitor, provided we have the right level of visibility. We can validate and provide you the proper output. We can do incident response. But when we hand off the work product with the recommendations that we have, that's on you. I have been doing this job for a long time across a lot of different companies. And one of the worst things as a service provider is handing off the recommendations for a customer to get rid of an attacker or to increase their resilience against threats or, you know, whatever it is, and then 3 months down the road have a recompromise using the exact same malware by the exact same group because they didn't fully pay attention to the spreadsheet that we gave them with all the compromised systems, or they decided that implementing this particular piece of technology was going to be too expensive. Well, now you're looking at two times the same incident response activities, which, let's face it, if you have a true breach, 200 to 300 hours is the low ball for incident response activities. Consider that the going rate for incident response, high-level incident response service, is $400 an hour. That's a lot of money that you just flush down the drain on services instead of buying that piece of technology, which was one incident response value.
Right.
So, and let me say this too. You as a customer may get this and not know what to do.
Right.
And if you don't know what to do, ask. Because if Wade gets it and Wade goes, this is your business, I don't know how you run your business, I don't know how to do that, but guess what? We've got resources, right? So I'm going to plug Rapid7 because this is the kind of stuff that we do. We get involved in basically in security advisory services. We're kind of the bucket of stuff that nobody else does, yep, right? So we're like the island of misfit toys in the world of security. And that's cool, right? Like, you can hand me this weird stuff and go, I don't know what to do with this, and we can take a look at it and we can try to find out what to do with it or make recommendations or whatever. But the point is, we have enough we have enough capability and we have enough entry points into the community that we can figure out what it is you need to do, even if it's not a one-size-fits-all kind of solution or approach, right? So a lot of people look for they look for shortcuts, and that's what I don't want. I don't want you to take a shortcut. I want you to do the right thing, but the right thing for you may not be the right thing for somebody else. So asking us, is this the right thing to do for us? We might say, we're not sure, but you know what? There's ways to find out,
right?
Don't be afraid of asking those questions too. So when you're handed this, again, inaction is the killer, because we see that too. We go in and we do baseline assessments. You know, we spend 4 weeks doing a baseline assessment. A year later, they haven't done anything. You know, you do another assessment and it's the same stuff. That's tragic. That's just money that you're throwing down the drain. You know, let's improve. Let's move forward. Ask the questions. We're a partner. We'll work with you.
Yep. So we're hitting the half hour because, of course, when you come on Security Nation, it's smooth talk. It's just good conversation. Boom, it hits.
What this podcast needs is beer.
I know it's Friday afternoon. I'm not sure why I don't. And unfortunately, what I have is just more coffee. But I guess I only have one last question. It would be, if you are on the island of misfit toys, which toy are you?
Me? What was that? The one, the Jack in the Box. No, he wasn't a Jack in the Box. Was he?
Yeah, no, he was
his name.
He was all around. There was Susie Wetzelot. There was the polka dotted elephant. I'm going to throw
that. You're making me look this up.
There's that tugboat. Wade seems like a tugboat.
I'll go with that, but I'm going to go ahead and age you guys real quick. I have no idea what you're talking
about. Oh, that is brutal.
So, Charlie in the Box.
There you go.
It's Charlie in the Box.
Yeah, and he talks like this. And
Wade, watch a Christmas special from time to time, all right?
Come on, Wade. It's Rudolph. It's classic.
It is classic.
Well, I remember it. But that's all right. I have less hair than both of you, so it doesn't matter. For those who can't see this on a podcast, I'm actually looking at the two of you. So, all right, guys, that was awesome. Thank you so much. I think Wade was on the first one. Now he's on the 25th one. We're rocking and rolling. This is great. And we'll certainly come back with other topics. But thank you to our community for asking for this one. That's fantastic. And to you two, gentlemen, I wish you adieu. And thanks again for the time. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you.
All right, guys.
Take care.
Later.
Right.
Bye. Bye.